yeah, as we start the period of Lent, as we've already heard, we begin a new series, and it's entitled The Road to the Cross. And it's called that really because this is a process that we see in the life of Jesus, incidents which kind of all lead us towards one moment. It's fascinating. It's like a beautifully put together play that is just scene by scene by scene. We come to that final crescendo and punchline, really. And today we begin by looking at John's account of Jesus' last great miracle, the raising of Lazarus, and how this moment is actually the trigger. It's the first step on the road to the cross. It's the moment at which, if you like, that road becomes irreversible. Okay. Now, I'm going to read this from John 11. But really, this whole piece of a story that we're going to look at starts in the chapter before, finishes later on in the next chapter. It's kind of a continuum. So it's quite a long reading. I apologize for it. No, I don't apologize because it's amazing stuff. But I'll do it. Okay. So, John 11. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with their hair. Just a note, that comes after this event. So this is looking backwards. Okay, we'll talk a bit about that in a minute. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." And when he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was for two more days. And then he said to his disciples, "Let us go to Judea." "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you're going back?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It's when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." After he said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." And the disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better, surely." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. And when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again." Sorry, has anybody?
24.
"I know he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day." That's right. Technical problems. Jesus said to her, "I'm the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she replied. "I believe you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world." And after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. And when Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "How he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of a blind man not have kept this man from dying?" Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there's a bad odour, for he's been there 4 days." And Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you'll see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I say this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped in strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Familiar story. It's interesting, isn't it, that the story of Lazarus appears only in John's Gospel. Which in itself is kind of curious, given the extraordinary significance which John gives to it. I mean, you would think, this is a very, very public miracle. There's a lot of people around at this moment in time. And it's very, very significant. It's a huge thing. Some commentators have kind of suggested that John's Gospel was, because it was edited by John and contributed by John, but not necessarily written by John, but maybe written by his followers, drew heavily on material from Luke's Gospel, where there is a parable of Lazarus, if you remember, the beggar. And John took that, or John's followers took that, and misrepresented the story as being factual as opposed to a parable. Looking at that, it's actually not a very credible argument. I can see where they get it from, but actually the only similarity is the name's the same. And believe it or not, Lazarus was a very common name. Don't hear so many, I actually don't know any Lazaruses today, but at the time it was a very common name. So the fictional character of Lazarus was about a beggar. Lazarus of Bethany is a historical character. And one of the very, very interesting things about this account is that there are so many eyewitnesses. There are sort of moments of, you can refer this. This is historical. You can go back and ask these people if you like. I'm naming them. Doesn't happen in a lot of Gospels. So John is actually taking something here and grounding it. So why it doesn't appear in the other Gospels, it's a matter of conjecture. It has to do, I believe, with what those Gospel writers were looking to do in what they were writing. John, if you remember, is absolutely obsessed with telling the story of Jesus' divinity. And this moment is actually the crowning moment. This is the moment where Jesus establishes exactly who he is, without any conjecture. We're left with a question, I suppose, why it's not in those other Gospels. I believe it's for John, it's a defining moment. It plays into his determination, and it also is something to do with John's closeness with Jesus. John was with Jesus in virtually every significant moment of Jesus' ministry. We don't know who the other disciples that were with him at the time were. We don't know, actually, if the Gospel writers were with him at this moment. We're not given that. The only one we know of, we'll talk about it in a minute. It's obvious that Jesus knew Lazarus as a very close friend. We're told he loved him. In fact, this is not the only time at which John picks up on things he found significant, which were perhaps not as evident in the other gospel writers. It's clear from his account, it's a retrospective overview chronicling the mission of Jesus rather than a narration of his life. So John is not attempting to do a history. John is looking back over Jesus' life and saying, this is what it was all about. And these are illustrations. So it's really important how you look at John's gospel. He picks out moments and he puts them in the context of Jesus' mission all the way through. There is a purpose for John recording what John records. In fact, it's not the only time which John picks up on things he found significant that were perhaps not as evident to other gospel writers. It's clear that this is a retrospective account, but the persons of Mary, Martha, and her brother Lazarus are referred to in the other gospels, and so are other elements of this story. Okay, so we'll have to leave it there because we don't know, but I'm reasonably convinced. Mary is indeed referred to as Jesus' spiritual sister and will later anoint Jesus' feet with oil. It's another story. So our account begins quite soon after Jesus has healed the man blind from birth. You'll remember that story. I spoke on it a while back. And you'll remember that after that moment, the Pharisees have just lost it. They are out to get him. They are trying to cancel the story. They're trying to remove the blind man or the cured man from history, effectively write him out. And Jesus is now a heretic. And they are inciting the mob. They are actually doing something which we're rather familiar in this day and age, which is, we talk about cancel culture being new. The Pharisees were doing a cancel culture job on Jesus, without doubt. That's exactly what they were trying to do. We read in John 10, verses 21 and 38 to 40, that Jesus then goes away from Jerusalem and that area and escapes effectively to a place on the east bank of the Jordan called Perea. Confusingly, this place is also referred to Bethany, but it's not the same Bethany. It's about 15 miles away from the Bethany that's close to Jerusalem. There's always a problem with place names. They tend to call them all sorts of things for some reason. But it was where John the Baptist had been preaching. So Jesus has gone back to the area where probably, we don't know exactly, but probably he was baptized himself. And that's where he was staying, and that's where he was talking, and ostensibly, probably, talking to people who had been John's disciples beforehand. Because we read that they were saying, well, John preached, but he never did the things that this man did. So clearly, Jesus was speaking to that cohort. And a messenger came from Martha and Mary, these two sisters who lived in Bethany, which is about a day's journey away. These were two fairly well-off ladies, by all accounts. But the problem was they were single. And as single, they didn't actually have any rights. And they couldn't own property. Fortunately, the brother, Lazarus, stayed with them, and Lazarus, I suppose, kept them safe and gave them the protection that they needed. What we do know about them is that the house at Bethany appears to have acted as like a centre of operations for Jesus. He was back there quite a lot. There appears to have been that sort of sense of, this is home for Jesus. This is somewhere where he's safe, somewhere he goes and people around him who he loves. Yeah. So it's an important place for him. And the message asks Jesus to come quickly to Bethany as Lazarus is very seriously ill. The message even describes Lazarus as the one you love. The one you love is ill. Do you get the pressure that, This is desperation. But, you know, the one you love, you better come quickly. You know, you're the one you love, you know. So there's pressure being placed on Jesus here. The disciples, however, when they hear this, say, "What? You've got to be kidding. They're about to stone you. Why on earth would you even consider going back there? I know he's ill, but, you know, guys, this is dangerous. We can't do this." So Jesus is under pressure from both ways. Disciples saying, "You can't possibly go." And Mary and Martha saying, "You must come. You must come." And Jesus doesn't do anything. We don't actually know what he did in those 2 days, but it says Jesus stayed put for 2 days. Does that mean Jesus was indecisive? Maybe I should go, maybe I should not. Ah, but it might be dangerous. No, no, no. Absolutely not. The disciples were indecisive. They reckoned that, you know, maybe he's just unwell. And Jesus confused matters by saying, "Well, he's sleeping." They said, "Oh, well, if he's just sleeping, you can just go and wake him up. That's fine." But then Jesus, "No, no, guys, you've got it wrong here. He's dead. He's dead." But he still doesn't jump up and just clear off. But then after 2 days, he suddenly says, "Right, we're off." And the disciples say, "No, no, 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 no." And Thomas, bless him, good old Thomas. I love Thomas. If there was a film, well, there's been loads of films of this, but if I was to cast in a film on this, Thomas would be John Laurie. All right? Private Fraser. "We're doomed. We're doomed. But we might as well all go and die together." You know, I love this guy. He actually persuades them. He says, "We might as well go and we can all die together. Won't that be fun?" Thomas has integrity. And he is fiercely loyal. Thomas, so many people our teaching over the years has given all these people a bad press. And we think Thomas, you know, he's a doubter and he's got doubts and fears and da da da. Thomas is the guy who stands there and goes with, even though he may not believe. Even though he may not be convinced. I wonder, you know, when we talk about ourselves and so often, you know, it's the easiest thing in the world to just say, "I've got a few doubts, so maybe, you know, I'll just see how it goes." Thomas says, "I have doubts, but I've committed myself to you, and that's where I'm going." It's an interesting thing. In John 11, 5-6, he waited for 2 days, then he invites them to go back. Thomas persuades them to come back with him. And the disciples couldn't understand what was going on. But by waiting, Jesus is not succumbing to pressure, and he's not showing indecisiveness. He's actually waiting for a specific period of time. And there's a purpose behind this. And the purpose, to understand that purpose, you have to understand Jewish law about death. Okay? In Jewish law, in temple law, there was a very old belief that the soul hangs around the body for 3 days, not wanting to let go. And it's only after 3 days that the soul departs the body. So the priests could not actually certify somebody dead until they had been dead for 3 days. And basically, after 3 days, that was it. There was absolutely no chance of anybody returning because the soul had gone. It had departed wherever the soul, they believed, went. So 3 days is important in the whole of the sort of their law and their legal processes. And, you know, you don't need me to tell you that 3 days dying thing, we pick it up in Jonah, 3 days in the whale. We pick it up in Lazarus. I mean, 4 days, but the reality is he's probably been dead in the tomb for 3 days. Because if we think about the time, he wasn't dead when the messenger left. That was the first day. 1 day down to Jesus. 2 days waiting. 1 day back. 4 days. 4 day process. Lazarus probably died sometime on the day that the messenger left. We're talking about 3 to 4 days. But it's after, the important thing is it after 3 days. And then, of course, we know that Jesus, 3 days in the tomb. Much of this is pointing in a way to Jesus' death and his resurrection, because so much happens that looks the same. The most likely scenario here is that, as I say, he's been dead for at least 3 days. And what's happened is that the mourners are still there. The mourners start to disperse after 3 days. Okay? So for 3 days, there's lots and lots of people around there, and there's everybody coming to pay their respects. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to an Irish wake. Have you ever been to an Irish funeral where somebody's laid out in the front room? I have. There is the tradition. It's the same tradition, believe it or not, that the soul is still with the body. The body lies in state. And you come and visit. And you come to visit for a period of time while the soul is still in some way in contact. It's interesting, isn't it? There's elements of this, exactly the same thinking going on with that. And Martha, Jesus arrives too late, as far as Martha goes. Lazarus is not only physically dead, but beyond recall, and is certified as such by the church. So they'll have done the paperwork. Too late, Jesus. He's dead and gone. There's nothing we can do about it now. You could have come and healed him. 3 days are gone. Too late. So the timing of all this is carefully staged. And I love the way that John just puts in this lovely little bit of extra graphic stuff from Martha. Not only is he dead, not only is he sealed up in the tomb, not only has the priest put the seal on the tomb saying that he's dead, but he smells. That's Martha, isn't it? That's good, practical Martha. He's smelly as well, you know. This is the moment. The timing has been so carefully staged, and John recognizes this, at least in retrospect, that this is like a precursor to Jesus' death and resurrection, even down to details like the stone being rolled away by the bystanders. This is the moment when Jesus will demonstrate not only who he is and the power he has over physical and spiritual death, but he'll also offer a glimpse of the pathway he must himself take. And that's why we look at this as being the start of the road to the cross. Commentators also point out to the personal response of Jesus to his sisters, as in Jesus wept, the famous shortest verse in the Bible. Do you know that the wept, though, is interesting? We think, that means Jesus cried, had a bit of a greet. No, the verb that is used for wept actually is the same one as used for an earthquake. Jesus quaked in anguish. We're reading Gethsemane, where when Jesus cried, he cried tears of blood. Jesus is overwhelmed by grief, overwhelmed by emotion. Now, I just want to take you somewhere here, because hang on. Jesus knows what's going to happen. Jesus knows he has authority over death. Jesus knows that he is going to raise Lazarus from the dead. Why the grief? Why did Jesus weep? Surely, it's all right, guys. I'm here. it's going to be all right. No. Jesus Commentators generally think that what Jesus is weeping over the concept of death. He's weeping from grief and anger at death itself and the tragic waste it represents. Death is the antithesis of creation. Death is corruption of what God has done, his life and his purpose. And the crowd said, look how he loved them. Meaning, look how he loved Lazarus, look how he loved Martha and Mary, because they perceived that that was what the grief was for. But in hindsight, we look at that and we say, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son, or alternatively, Jesus so loved all people that he gave his life for the sake of all. Jesus' grief is for mankind, not for Lazarus. He knows what will happen to Lazarus. Jesus grieves over the fate of mankind. Okay, Jesus' return will have attracted lots of attention. Besides the disciples and hangers-on, there will have been mourners, there will be curious villagers, there will be Pharisee officials, there will be lawyers, you know, there will be the local newspaper obituary writer, you know, whatever they, the whole game. Quite a crowd. And Martha and Mary, the one criticizing Jesus for coming too late and the other one saying, look, you know, if you'd been here, it wouldn't have all happened in the first place. But beyond all of that and beyond everyone looking at the drama being played out, because this is drama, this is high drama. Everyone notices Jesus crying. Everyone notices Martha getting stroppy. Everyone notices Mary. Jesus takes control. He takes center stage, and this is a staged thing. That's not being irreverent. This is a staged moment in time. Jesus responds to Martha in a way that everyone can hear. Martha doubts whether he could do anything, but at least accepts that Lazarus will be raised. And Jesus puts her right and says, no. I'm not just talking about spiritual resurrection. Yes, Lazarus will be raised spiritually. And then he utters these astonishing words of John 11, 25 to 26. These words condemn Jesus. They are some of the most important, probably the most important lines in the Bible. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will never die. I am the resurrection. This is Jesus openly saying, I am God. There's no going back from that moment. The Rubicon has been crossed. I am the resurrection. I am the life. Jesus is stating that he's both the path to eternal life but also has authority over physical life. And Jesus then does something he actually told people not to do, which is make a public prayer. You remember that Jesus said, you know, don't do that. The Pharisees do that. Don't make these public prayers. That's for show. This is for show. Jesus admits it's for show. Jesus says to him, Father, I'm doing this, I'm praying aloud to you because I want people to glorify you. I want people to know that this is you, this is your power. And then he tells the onlookers to open the tomb. We're not told if there was a bit of an uproar. You can't open that tomb. Remember, under Jewish law, it's an abomination to touch a dead body. Certainly one that's been certified dead. But they roll the stone away. We don't know who rolled the stone away. And Lazarus is called out. And it's interesting, isn't it? That Lazarus is called. The authority is with the word. In the beginning, the word. In the beginning, the word created. In the beginning, Jesus was the word, John brings that whole thing together. And the word of creation calls Lazarus from his tomb. And there is a big dissimilarity between Jesus' resurrection and Lazarus coming out of the tomb. Lazarus comes out of the tomb like this. Lazarus is bound. He's swaddled. You've seen mummification. You've seen how mummies are dressed. You've seen how shrouds are. It's not actually possible to get out of that. I don't know exactly. I mean, I gather that, you know, it sounds from, you know, that sort of he was having to be helped with bits of grave clothing coming off. I have this horrible sort of, I don't know, image of Lazarus going. But, however, Jesus, of course, when they go to find Jesus, the grave clothes are gone. They're put to one side. The difference is that Lazarus has been resurrected in a physical body. He's been healed of death. When Jesus is resurrected, Jesus is resurrected in a spiritual body. There's been no problem with actually passing through the grave clothes, which is why they were just there. Like, there should have been a body and the body's just gone. So that's the big difference. Lazarus is not being raised in a new spiritual body. Lazarus has been healed from death. He's been brought back as a physical human being. And Lazarus, Lazarus goes on, as far as we know, to live, we believe, about another 30. He was about 30 when he died, and we believe he lived about another 30 years. 6 days before Jesus goes into Jerusalem, he's recorded in John 12, 1 and 2, as eating with Jesus and the sisters at a dinner that they gave in Jesus' honour. So he was clearly not smelly by that time. And Orthodox tradition claims he fled persecution from the Pharisees, something we read about in John 12, sometime after the crucifixion, and went to Cyprus, where he became a bishop. We don't know, but that's certainly their tradition. I found it very interesting that the name Bethany, the place which was then called Bethany, is now called Al-Ghizariah, or Ghizariah, and that translates as the place of Lazarus, which I found fascinating. And they've recently found two gravestones, effectively, to Osiris, with Martha and Lazarus. So, you know, maybe a coincidence, common names. But the point being, really, that these are historical figures and that they are recorded, and Lazarus goes on and eventually dies. There's nothing special about the resurrected Lazarus. He's just been brought back to life. And we'll go on and carry on living and then die. But whatever we know, Lazarus dies eventually, although throughout his life he continues to testify to the miracle, which I guess made him a pretty compelling witness. I'd have loved to have been at one of his sermons, wouldn't you? You know, I'm not going to waste my time getting preaching a sermon. Jesus, I was dead and Jesus brought me back to life. Believe that or not, sunshines, you know. Okay, the impact of this miracle, utterly profound. John records that as a result, many believed in Jesus. You bet they would. I mean, wow. But some did not. And they ran off to senior church leaders to tell them what had happened. How could anyone not believe after that? Sadly, as Jesus himself observed, signs, wonders, even overwhelming proof does not change the minds of those committed to a specific path or belief. Still today, we see that if someone wishes to believe in something, then no amount of proof or evidence to the contrary will change that. I've often heard people say, oh, if only God would do this, or if only God do that, then people would believe in him and it would be wonderful. Sadly, that's not the case, is it? We know that even today, and people believe the strangest of things with the least evidence or complete evidence to the contrary, simply because they want to. It's interesting what we choose. Okay, and I'm going on, but that said, really, things have changed from this day. Jesus is no longer an itinerant rabbi or preacher, of which there were many at the time, nor is he a subversive or a trickster. In fact, unlike anything he's done before, this last great miracle has no explanation. You can't explain it away. Too many people saw it. It can't be spun. It can't be defined as fake news. The genie's well and truly out of the bottle, and too many people have either seen it or heard about it. And they've gone back to Jerusalem, and they've told everybody. Jesus may have been a mere figure of interest, but now he's a celebrity. Everybody is talking. Can you imagine how that story went around? Can you imagine? Everyone is talking about him. That's why when they go into Jerusalem for the Passover, that's why there are crowds. Had you ever wondered that? Why should there be great celebrating crowds when Jesus went into Jerusalem? Why do we have Palm Sunday? Why were all these people lining the roads? Hang on, they weren't doing that before. There weren't people lining the roads in you know, wherever else he went, waving banners and say, blessed is he who comes. No, this was the direct result of this moment. The message had got across. Everybody wanted to see the man who raised Lazarus from the dead. And here's Lazarus telling you about it, just to prove it. What a change. That's amazing. A seismic shift in power. The Sanhedrin can't ignore things anymore. They can't hope local mobs are going to deal with him. And from this moment, Jesus' fate is literally sealed. John gives us a little fascinating insight into the discussions between the chief priest, Caiaphas, and the other officials later on in the chapter. Caiaphas turns around and because they're saying, you know, we're going to have to get rid of this guy. But he does all these things and people are going to object. And Caiaphas rather chillingly turned around and said, it's more advantageous for one man to die for the people than the whole nation perish. Expressing the view that if the crowds followed Jesus, then the Romans would respond. They would come in, they would establish martial law, probably absorb Israel. There would be no more nation, no more high priest, no more Caiaphas. All of their nice little cushy lives would have been gone. We think very badly of Caiaphas, don't we? Caiaphas, the evil high priest who had... He's just expressing politics. Caiaphas is a politician. Caiaphas is doing nothing here but expressing the politics of greater good, while at the same time finding a way for Romans to be responsible for it all so they don't have to carry the guilt. Do you know, we happily accept James Bond, License to Kill. Killing people for the greater good is all right, isn't it? If it's in the right cause. Caiaphas is doing nothing more. Caiaphas is making a political decision. But at the same time, Caiaphas prophesies exactly what Jesus is doing. Because Jesus will die for the whole nation. In fact, he will die for all nations. And for the benefit of them. Tragically, just a few years later, having decided to do away with Jesus, the very thing that they were worried about happens. Rome invades, subsumes Israel and completely destroys the power of the temple. The raising of Lazarus is absolutely the start of what we would recognize today as the culmination of Jesus' life and ministry. And it ends not so much with the command, Lazarus, come out. That's the big showstopper. That's the moment. But I believe that it ends with those words to Martha. Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. If you believe in me, you'll never die. Do you know, as the Sanhedrin plans to get rid of this significant inconvenience, I wonder if there was at least a tiny question in the minds of a few of them about what might happen when you try to put to death a man who has already not only claimed but demonstrated authority over death. I wonder.